Okay, mics are on.
Here we go.
The conference committee will reconvene. I figured if I dropped the gavel, the seats would magically fill here at the table. So just so the public knows what we're going to do now, and the audience in situ, Senate has made an offer back to the House. We are going to make the terms that offer available to everyone in the room, and we're going to walk through it as well so we can answer any questions, make sure everyone understands what our proposal is. Is Representative Paymar on his way?
He was here, and then he was walked down the hall and saw him when I came in. He'll come back.
I'm certainly not going to start until colleague from the House is here. But the mics are on, so watch what you say.
1 month younger.
Senator Lance.
You look alike. Oh, you wouldn't say that.
Good, are you?
A little shell-shocked.
Yeah,
I've been there before.
I listened in.
Okay.
Oh, well. John Stewart, if he were kind.
Okay, while you are all are grabbing the copies, I will also note that the Senate Finance Committee is going right now, and we may have to recess while Senators Goodwin, Limmer, and I go to Finance. So I'm going to ask Mr. Turner to walk us through the Senate offer, and please, if you have any questions, jump right in as we're going through it and ask them, and we will do our best to help you understand the basis for what we did. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think it'd be safe to characterize the House offer. The Senate thought that was a very serious offer. The senators did have a couple of the major components of the Senate counteroffer is to get rid of all the fees in the bill, so that's about $4 million, and to reinstate the data integration and the mental illness data to NICS, and that's another $1 million. So we had to come up with close to a little over $5 million. And this is the sheet that shows you the changes that we made. And I'll the first change is on line 8. Like I said, the Senate reinserted the $250,000 for the Supreme Court data integration project. That was part of Senate File 235, Senator Latz's gun bill. The next line,
that was the non-controversial portion of the overall package that was debated in various places throughout the legislature. Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, so does this offer include that bill in its entirety or the amendment that's been floating around?
Representative Hillstrom, the goal, if it works out, still trying to put things into place, my goal anyway, is to be able to take the Senate File 235 content that was originally in Senator Ortman's bill, which contains just the civil commitment database information and the court integration database information. There were some other pieces in Senate File 235 that also had a fiscal impact, which is why they were contained in there and went through the Finance Committee and didn't go straight to the floor in Senate File 458. And it is not my intent to take up any of those other pieces. So it would just be filling in the gaps in the existing databases that the state is required by federal law to be transmitting to NICS, but which we don't have the data in the proper format to be able to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that does not include the prosecutor's package, which is Representative Lesch's bill, which is currently in that proposal, or pieces of it are.
It does not include any of those pieces. That's correct. My goal it was, if I can get consensus from all those who had an interest in this issue, then we can move forward with a consensus piece. Candidly, I was not interested in negotiating new pieces or trying to negotiate compromises on any of the pieces. There are things that clearly are going to be left for another day. But at least this piece, since we had in the Senate bill, we had the funding mechanism in place. Since next year is not a budget year, if we don't take care of that this year, I thought it was far less likely that we could accomplish that in a non-budget year when the money's been spent somewhere else. So I was hoping at least to find that piece, which on its face, as far as I could tell, was non-controversial on the parts of everyone that was involved in that discussion. We could move that piece forward and could leave the policy, the other policy pieces, and the other pieces that had some of their own smaller fiscal aspects to them for discussion at another day. I was not interested in reigniting any debates or conflicts over this issue, just trying to find a pathway for this narrowly focused consensus piece.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that you've been saying as time has been going on is that provisions that did not make it out of the Senate would not be included in your bill. This is one provision that did not even have a hearing in the House, Mr. Chair. So is that a change in policy in relationship to this bill and what is eligible to be included in offers?
Well, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure what all happened to your bill in the House in terms of what got passed out of committee. I know most of these provisions were also in your bill when it was introduced in the House anyway. And I'm not sure exactly what passed out of committee in terms of these provisions. So you might have to educate me on that part. It was my intent, if all the pieces fall into place, to have this matter heard tomorrow morning in Senate Finance Committee, where they are in the Senate File 235, and passed out of the Finance Committee in the Senate, where they would go to the Senate floor. And then, if we can reach consensus on including them in this bill, that would be my desire. If we can't, then it will sit there and it will remain out of compliance with federal law, and we'll see if there's any way to fund it next year, or it simply won't happen. So, as I said, I'm not looking to reignite any of the battles that happened earlier this session, only to see if there's a pathway for a consensus item here.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, the Senate agreed with the House offer on the judges' salaries, kind of split the difference at a net of 3-3 for the three courts. The next change is on line 27. The Senate deleted the Court of Appeals reimbursement provision in the House.
Mr. Chair, if I could get clarification as to the thinking behind eliminating that $46,000.
Representative Hillstrom, that provision did not, it was, let me think here. Ms. Joachim, who had that bill here in the Senate?
Senator.
We didn't hear it at all in our finance division.
Reinhardt. Senator Reinhardt.
This was Senator Reinhardt's bill, as I recall, and he introduced it but did not make a hearing request to the full finance committee, so it was not sent from full finance down to our division. So we never even had an opportunity to hear it.
Well, that wasn't that one.
That was not that one? This is a different Reinhardt bill?
This is just Court of Appeals.
Okay. Well, we didn't hear it in our division. So Our position at this time is not to fund it. As I understand it, the judiciary system is not, the court system is not asking for it either.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
This provision has been around for a couple of years now. The judiciary has, you know, had the opportunity to do this themselves and to sort of form it how they've wanted to, and you're correct that they've chosen not to. They didn't ask for this provision, but it has been something that's been pursued for a couple of years in both the House and the Senate. And I did forward the conferees an email from one of the judges in Greater Minnesota on behalf of the five appellate judges in Greater Minnesota, expressing the importance of having this provision in the bill. It did have a full hearing with testimony in the House. The judiciary was present in the hearing room and chose not to testify against the bill. You know, that being said, I don't think that they're supportive of it, but they didn't testify against it, and it did have a full hearing in the House and passed through.
Senator Goodman.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused on this one. Is this the $46,000? Does this have something to do with them being able to maintain two homes and mileage and so forth?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, yes, this is for the appellate court judges that live in Greater Minnesota. State statute requires that there be one appellate court judge from each of the eight congressional districts. The idea behind it was to add geographic diversity to the court. So right now there are five judges living outside the metro area, greater than 50 miles from their chambers in St. Paul. There's one north of Duluth, one in Moorhead, New Ulm, Owatonna. I don't remember where the fifth one is from. But they come down here all week long and then sort of go back home on the weekends to their families and homes in Greater Minnesota, just as legislators do. So this was Walker, I'm sorry, is where the fifth one is. So this is just to allow them to have mileage reimbursement from traveling to their permanent residence to the chambers in St. Paul, and then a housing per diem, just as Greater Minnesota legislators often have.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
Don't the courts have the option of doing that now? I mean, as we do it for our senators and representatives that live out of the metro area, can't they do a reimbursement on their own? Do we have to have specific language and funding for that?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, they could do it on their own. They've chosen not to. I originally introduced this bill 2 years ago because the Greater Minnesota judges came to me and asked for it. So, you know, the courts have had over 2 years now to do this on their own and have chosen not to. So that's why it's being pursued legislatively. And the effective date isn't until 2015, I believe.
So
it gives the courts a little time to adjust.
Senator Goodwin.
So then it really wouldn't have to be funded this year. It could be funded next year or the year after, too, as long as it's not effective until 2015.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I think it was Representative Hillstrom that changed the effective date, so maybe she could.
Certainly. So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Goodwin. We didn't have enough. Sorry, Senator Goodwin. I apologize, Senator.
That's okay. Don't count it.
Okay.
We didn't have enough money in our budget target to fund it in the first year. It was our intention to do that if we would have had the money to do that. Our budget target, as you know, had fees in it, and we did not have the same budget target that the Senate had. So we did choose to implement it in the second year, but as next year is not a fiscal year, in order to fund it, that's why we funded it in the second year of our spreadsheet.
So one final question on that. I know it's a little issue, so I won't go on and on, but just having a little trouble thinking that the courts have not wanted to do this, and we're telling them they have to do it.
Sure. Representative Lush.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the logic of this is that, yes, the courts could do this if they wanted to. It's part of Court of Appeals culture, whereby you get appointed to the court, And you leave your home chambers and you come down to the Twin Cities and hang out with the legal community here and relocate your home here to be permanently part of that brain trust. I understand the court's culture in doing that. However, we by statute say that they have to come from some rural Minnesota districts or the other congressional districts. And in doing so, I think it's up to us as a legislature to decide whether or not we want our judges from those districts to maintain some rural connection of where they came from. So that's why I think it's our prerogative to make that determination in light of the fact that we're the ones that say where they come from. The courts, of course, decide it's our prerogative to keep them here and ensure they stay here. But that's why I think the ball kind of is in our court on that front.
Yeah, that's what I think. Okay. Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I mean, I think it's also along with what Representative Lesch said, the same as, you know, we're giving pay raises to district court judges. As far as the appellate court goes, we do have trouble in greater Minnesota to have people apply for at-large positions with the appellate court and for even the congressional district openings for the appellate court because of the cost that they have to incur by having a chambers in St. Paul. So, for example, our appellate court judges who live in greater Minnesota right now actually have lower take-home pay than if they would be to a district court judge in their home district because of the cost that they incur by maintaining a home in St. Paul and their permanent residency. The appellate court judge from Moorhead, for example, has young children, so he comes down here all week long and then goes home on the weekends, just as legislators from greater Minnesota would do. We do have difficulty getting people to apply, like I said, because of the cost that they have to incur by having their chambers in St. Paul. Yet I do think that there's some value to having some geographic diversity on the appellate court. So that's sort of the idea behind this provision. And, you know, in light of the fact that the greater Minnesota appellate court judges have come to us to sessions in a row now and have asked for this reimbursement. And it's a very modest amount for a handful of judges.
So we have the rather awkward situation of members of the judiciary bypassing the judiciary and coming to the legislature for financial help. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, we serve, I guess, you know, for example, when the judge from north of Duluth first came to me, he lived in my legislative district, and that's why he came to me, because I was his legislator. After redistricting, he now actually no longer lives in my district, and in fact, he wouldn't even benefit from this language because it's not effective until 2015, and he'll be retiring before then. But yes, it's true that, you know, Court of Appeals judges went to their legislators and asked for a legislative change in order to, I think, you know, better serve the judiciary. They may not agree, but it's a pretty modest request.
And Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It isn't the first time that we've had initiatives from other parts, not just the judiciary. For example, I've carried things over the years for Hennepin County courts that didn't necessarily go through the Judicial Council. And so it isn't like this is the first time that there has been a proposal. We actually have another proposal in this bill where we're actually the court is asking for money to fund a project that is something I'm interested in funding, an initiative that I've worked on. And so it wasn't a court initiative. The court isn't asking for the money to do it. But we think it's important as a body. We voted on the proposal, and so we're going to give the judiciary money to do it, even though they didn't ask for the money, and it's not their initiative.
There is a difference between judges and legislators, though, in that it's a full-time, year-round job to serve on the Court of Appeals, and it's a job that is based in St. Paul. They don't lose their position if they give up a residence in greater Minnesota, where we as legislators are mandated by the Constitution to reside in the districts that we represent, and it's only a part-time, I shouldn't say only, it seems a lot more than part-time right now. But it's certainly only, you know, part of the year. So we have a constitutional obligation to maintain a residence in our home districts, which is quite different than judges. And by the way, they're getting a salary increase in our bill, just
right,
like the district
yeah.
court judges are. And they're starting, they're getting the same percentage increase starting from a higher base.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to make it really clear that these judges still, even if they don't live in the district, they can move and be in St. Paul, but they have to run for office again in their judicial district. So you're saying, okay, we want you to move to St. Paul to keep this full-time job, but oh, by the way, go back to your legislative district and run for election, because they do have to run again, even once they're appointed, when their term expires.
Representative Cornish.
I don't think we should quibble about such a small amount of money for such a good cause. I'm in favor of it, too. I got one of the judges at a, down in my area that would really appreciate the boost, help pay the expenses. I think it's a good idea.
All right. Any other discussion on this topic? Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, the next change...
Oh, I'm sorry. I did ask one other question. What were the tails on that line item? Do we have that information?
Yes. The first year is $46,000, the second year is $115,000, and the third year is $135,000.
And is it projected that that $135,000 then would be the tails going on that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that because it wasn't in our bill. But do you, I mean.
Mr. Walls, do you know?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note provided by the courts only goes out to the four-year period of your standard fiscal note. So I believe the fiscal note was only done through 2017.
Okay. It's just sometimes we get fiscal notes where the tails are the same in each of the two out years, and here it's sloping upwards. So I wasn't sure if that meant that the slope would continue up or if it would flatten out on that fourth year going beyond that. If we don't know, we don't know. We don't know.
Mr. Chair, the courts obviously had some reason to put a growth factor in. I don't know if they want to comment or... but I think it was leveling off as far as I could tell.
All right. Well, at some point, if the courts can provide us with some information on that. Do you know the answer to that now, Ms. Marshall?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I did prepare this fiscal note. The reason that the cost goes up is because under current law, we do provide mileage and housing reimbursement for 2 years. So what we did is it goes up higher as they fall off of that statutory obligation.
And Ms. Marshall, do you know if then the fourth year here in this budget, the second year of the tail budget, would that level off going forward from there based on your analysis, or would it continue to slope upward?
Our analysis shows that originally we had done it in FY14, it would have been 58, and FY15, it would have been 115. And then 16 and 17, it levels off to 135 each year.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. And members, I would suspect the idea was that they can transition to their new job location in St. Paul, and then anticipated they took a job that's headquartered in the new city, and they'd be expected to live there.
Well,
but that's theory anyway, I suppose. Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, I mean, just on that note, I mean, I think us, you know, legislators from Greater Minnesota, we do value geographic diversity, and the judiciary is the third branch of government. These judges, like the one in Moorhead, has four young children and a wife, and I don't think that we can expect her to leave her job and to uproot all of his children to fulfill his obligations in the Court of Appeals. It's just like us members from Greater Minnesota who leave our families and permanent residents behind all week long to come to St. Paul. So, you know, I think that there is value in having the geographic diversity, which is why state statute requires that there be one judge from each congressional district. That was the idea behind it when the Court of Appeals went from 11 members to the current 19 members. So there's 11 at-large positions and one from each congressional district. So there was a public policy reason behind it then, and I think this is a, you know, the similar public policy reason now.
All right. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and members, the next change from the House offer is on line 38, and we deleted the funding for the Guardians and Conservators bill. That was carried by Senator Latz in the Senate and by Representative Gilstrom in the House. Our reasons for that was the $61,000 represented 0.7 of one court auditor. And in speaking with the courts, when we heard the bill in the Senate, they said that they could absorb that.
Mr. Turner, before we go on, I know that just to make clear, if we jump back up to line 36, this is not a change from the House offer, but I just wanted to reiterate that we have accepted the House proposal with regard to the judge's salary, 4% in the first year, 3% in the second year. And then I think there was some language that was in the Senate bill that we sought to keep, but the numbers would be the House's proposal from the last offer.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the language is actually the language that's being carried in the Senate Health and Human Services bill rather than the what's in your bill, because that's where the...
No, this is the judge's salary increase on line 36. I changed topics.
Got it.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe after Mr. Turner goes through the changes from the spreadsheet, we can go over the other item we gave you, which tries to dispose of the remaining policy provisions, and these two provisions will be addressed there as well.
I'm going to say 3 and 3.
I'll have an explanation when we get to it.
That's fine. I just want to assess 3 and 3.
Representative Pammeyer has a question. That item, it says 3%, 3% on our on the other sheet. Mr. Turner, can you explain that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it comes out to 3% net. The 1% the first year is the judge's portion for his pension share. So the actual increase would net out to 3 and 3.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your offer is actually 4 and 4 for the judges?
No.
So it's 3 in the first year, with 1% going to the pension.
Additional 1%.
Yes, additional 1%. 3 in the second year with an additional 1%.
With no additional 1% in the second year, which is what we understood the House offer to be.
It was, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
As part of a package, Mr. Chair.
Well, understood, but we're all on the same page with regard to that that line. Okay, and then the other thing I'll point out is on line 37, with regard to the additional specialty court funding, the Senate accepts the House position on the specialty court funding without any change. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, then if you can move down to line 56. This is an issue that came to my attention last week. Tax court sent a letter and pointed out that their judges are their salaries are statutorily attached to district court salaries. So when we raise the district court salaries, the tax courts automatically go up as well. So we inserted that. I did make one mistake here. There would be tails out there. I'll add that if we retain this. Okay, the next change is lines 79 to 83, the entire Public Defense Board appropriation. Like I pointed out before, the numbers are very close. There's only $300,000 difference between the Senate and the House. The Senate accepted, or the Senate went with our number, and our allocation. So that's a $300,000 difference. The next change is on...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you could actually make some clarification on your transcript language, Mr. Chair. So you're accepting your transcript language that basically makes it an additional line item ongoing forever to the base of the transcripts. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Representative Hillstrom.
So, Mr. Chair, because you're taking that out of... So currently they have 25 lawyers that are funded out of that $1.9 million. You're actually cutting that and only giving them 1.7, and then you're removing an additional $200,000 per year, so an additional $400,000. How many lawyers would that be a loss of for the public defenders based on the way you fund it?
Representative Hillstrom, it's not our intention for there to be any loss of lawyers. We have it broken out in the line items, whereas the House lumped it all together into one line item on line 79 initially. The total at the end of the day in terms of the funding was $300,000 apart. The House was $300,000 higher than the Senate was. Public defense had come in asking for funding for the defense corporations. They'd come in asking for information technology funding, and they told us exactly the amount that they anticipated needing. And in terms of the transcript base, I don't recall exactly if that came from the public defenders or if it was from the public defenders along with some of the court reporters that weren't being paid. I think the anticipation was that they were going to be paying for that probably out of their main appropriation anyway, because the main appropriation included funding not only for retention, but as well as some funding available for new hires. So I don't think there was any anticipation that there would be a loss of positions as a result of the Senate's overall funding, just that we specified a couple of the areas in which the funding would be directed to so that everyone would be clear that that was the purpose and the money would, in fact, go for those designated purposes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'd like to get some clarification, if we could, from the Public Defender's Office about what the difference would mean if we allocate it this way in terms of loss of attorneys, because just the loss of $300,000, I can imagine, is a few lawyers from the $1.9 million in which they were used to get from the court attorney registration fee. So they were going to lose lawyers. So and the governor wanted to add to the number of lawyers. And so I'm just trying to figure out what the net number of lawyers that they're going to get to keep from the House version versus your proposal, Mr. Chair?
Well, we can certainly ask them, but if you'll note from the governor's line, his total public defense number is about $4 million less than the House and the Senate. Even on line 79, the employee salary from the governor's and the caseload reduction line is also lower in total than either the House or the Senate. So
Mr. Chair.
He wasn't funding it as generously as either body of the legislature proposes to fund it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think at the time that the governor put together his budget, there still was the request to the Supreme Court to actually fund that $75 attorney registration. And so now that that is not part of the solution, I believe that it will be a net loss of lawyers if we don't straight up replace. Now, the governor, I think, intended to fund additional, 30 lawyers or something along those lines. But I think that when you take the $1.9 million and you actually reallocate, it's actually $700,000. I mean, to me, that sounds like an awful lot of lawyers. But.
Well, why don't we ask if there's someone here from the Board of Public Defense who can...
We're needed in finance.
I'm sorry, before we do that, we've received a message from the Senate Finance Committee that we are needed there. So we're going to have to recess until three of us anyway can return.
Sure. Does it make me...
I guess everyone left finance and came in here now. So we're going to jump back in here and ask the Public Defense Board to come forward. And tell us how many fewer, if any, public defenders you would be able to fund with the Senate's proposed dramatic increase in your funding compared to the House's proposed
dramatic
increase in your funding.
Mr. Chairman, that's pretty dramatic. For the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Chairman, obviously, you know, as you look at the House and Senate positions, our preference would be the House position. The board's position always has been they're the best ones to allocate funding based on the board's priorities. So that's what we can tell you. On lines 79 and 80, I do want to make it clear in the conference position that off the top, there would need to be that $1.9 million, which you all have been discussing, would have to come off the top of before we would add any new hires, before there'd be any salary increases, because that's just to maintain the existing funding based on the loss of that $75 attorney registration fee that Representative Hillstrom referenced earlier. So as you go down the Senate position or the conference position, it is about an $800,000 difference over the two-year period, because you do spell out those three riders in your bill. Now, whether or not those would be three positions the board ultimately would adopt, they may not be at those full funding levels, at least for two of them, because the request for the Public Defense Corporations and the request for the information technology staffing would have assumed that there was full funding of the board's request, which obviously you all weren't able to do given your target. So those would be two things that the board would, I'm sure, end up doing something with in terms of allocating new funding. Whether or not they'd allocate what you have in the bill, that I don't know. I will tell you the technology piece, staffing is a priority, obviously. We've had that discussion with both the House and the Senate folks in terms of the direction of not only where the court is going, but where prosecutors are going with e-disclosure and all of those things. So,
now, Mr. Kyer, we heard directly from the Board of Public Defense that the $970,000 is your number for your information technology staffing needs, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That's one of our three budget requests.
And I presume that you have determined in past years, despite receiving increases in public defense funding compared to other areas of the budget, that you haven't been able to fund the information technology needs of the Board of Public Defense, right?
Mr. Chairman and members, the board has made conscious decisions in the past to put money into direct services to clients. And rightly or wrongly, that's the decision that they've made over the years. Has that now caught up with us? Maybe it has to some extent. And there's a recognition that we need to move more into this area in terms of this technology help for our lawyers. And I think you, the lawyers around the table, understand that. You all are dealing in your private practices with some of these same issues in terms of disks that you get where there's e-disclosure you can't open. When the court does go to a full e-court system, we have 200 part-time public defenders out there that we don't provide any service to right now on the technology front. We're going to have to do something with those folks. Again, whether it would be at that same level, given the fact that all of the budget request wasn't funded, That I couldn't tell you, but it is a budget request. Obviously, it was a priority for the board to put that in and put it in at that level.
Mr. Kyra, it's very easy to hope and project that you'll spend X number of dollars on information technology and then under pressures from other human sources to divert the resources toward the human sources rather than toward the technology, which is how organizations get years and years behind in their technology funding. And it was the Senate's position that it made sense to silo that money out so that you wouldn't come back in 2 years and say, we didn't spend anywhere near the money we needed to on technology. Now it's going to cost us 50% more, and we ask you to fund us in that amount.
Mr. Chairman and members, I understand that, and that message will be relayed loud and clear to the board. I will tell you, and I want to make clear, is it does take away from what we're able to do on the other side of the ledger, which is either salary increases or benefit increases or adding new staff. Because if you're going to carve that out, just like you carve anything else out, you're taking it away from a limited pot of money.
I think the Senate understood that when we siloed the money.
And I did, Mr. Chairman,
to insulate the board from those pressures to make sure that the technology investments were made. Let me ask you about, I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom, did you want to add on the technology piece?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kyra, so the technology pieces that are in the Senate's offer, which were your request, that's for technology staff, not for the actual physical technology pieces. Is that correct, Mr. Kyra?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Representative Hillstrom, that's correct. This is, no matter what we do with an electronic case and content management system, is there a need for these folks? Absolutely.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kyra, the House position actually had a technology fee where the Public Defender's Office would be eligible to apply for additional technology resources in the actual physical technology pieces. Is that something that the Public Defender's Office would support?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman,
Kyra.
Representative Hillstrom, yes, I think we've talked about that. I think you had testimony from our information systems person, Robert Sikora, back in February maybe or March. It's an important piece because we're gonna go forward. We need to go forward with an electronic case and content management system. We understand that, and we understand somehow we're going to have to pay for that through some combination of funding sources.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kyra, I believe the testimony that we heard was that your technology parts, not the people, in this biennium were going to cost you approximately $2.5 million in this biennium, and that the cost in the out years would add up to more than $7 million. Does that sound like an accurate figure from my memory?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I wasn't at that particular hearing, but I will tell you that the McGladrey Company, they will have a report in June, and I would be very surprised if it doesn't come back with at least those amounts in terms of the pieces we're going to need on a statewide basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Kyra, did you ask that the money be siloed in your budget?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kyra.
Representative Hillstrom, we did not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Chair, just a question for you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the board did not ask for the money to be siloed in the public defender account, and the Senate thinks that that's okay, why is it not okay for the House to silo money within the budget of the court to pay for Representative Moline's provisions for the Court of Appeals? It seems to me that it's the same behavior here, and you think one is appropriate and one is not.
Representative Hillstrom, the court wasn't even asking for money at all relating to Representative Moline's proposal. They've already got in their budget the funding for the 2 years transition, and they have not seen fit to even tell us that they want to fund anything beyond that. Public Defense Board has made clear they want to fund more, It's just a question of whether or not they're allowed to exercise their discretion to pick the exact dollar and time of appropriation, or whether we fund it in a separate line here. The difference is the courts didn't ask for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kyer, on the transcript base increase, my understanding is that court reporters were having to wait 6 or 7 months to get paid for the transcripts that they prepared at the request of the Public Defense Board under the current budget. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman and members, there is it's a little more complicated than that, if you indulge me for just a couple of minutes. Is we set aside a certain amount, we budget a certain amount for transcripts. We then tap into an emergency fund that the legislature set up partially for transcripts for those costs. So once we run out of those two pieces, we sit on transcript billings, and we wait and see till the end of the year, as we get closer to the end of the year, are we going to have money available to pay for those? This year, we did run out of money 6 or 7 months easily. And it was an unusual year. I suspect we will spend somewhere around $800,000 this year. And there's a variety of reasons for that. It is an unusual year. But there are just about every year that the court reporters do have to wait.
Mr. Carr, my understanding is under state law, if you submit a bill to the state has a contractor or doing business with the state pays you within 30 days. I think that number is accurate. I'm seeing some heads nod around the table that I'm got the right number.
Supposed to be that way.
Yet the Board of Public Defense is not paying people for their services and some of their materials for 6 or 7 months. Why is it that the Board of Public Defense should be entitled to delay paying those people who are working for a living and not getting paid for their services?
Mr. Chairman and members, the board's made a conscious decision not to sacrifice staffing for transcripts. And if we had to sacrifice that to fully fund that budget for transcripts, that would take probably 3 or 4 lawyers out of our appellate office, out of a group of 28 or 30 lawyers. And so the board has made that conscious decision. They're not going to increase that budget. We have no control over the cost. We have no control over what we order or what we need to order. We have no control over the per-page rate. We have no control over how many words go on a page. I'm sympathetic to the court reporters, trust me, because I've met with them on numerous occasions. And our interest is only in getting the material that our folks need to do their job.
Mr. Kyer,
those transcripts.
Do the appellate lawyers in your office get paid on every 2 weeks or every month like they're supposed to be?
Mr. Chairman, they do.
Well, Mr. Kyer, the Senate has siloed this money aside so that the board doesn't have the option of telling court reporters they have to wait 6 or 7 months to get paid for their services. And if we don't silo this money, there's nothing that would stop the Board of Public Defense from doing it again and again and again. And I personally don't think it's fair to expect court reporters to work for free when no one else in your office does. And that's why it's siloed the way it is, members of the House.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification. So is the amount that is siloed, is that the proper amount for what you think you need in court reporter money? So, for example, if we said we were going to give you the $1.9 million to fund your lawyers, and then we were going to give you what you needed for transcripts, how much money would that transcript amount need to be, and is that reflective of the Senate's number?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Kyer.
Representative Hillstrom, with what we budget now and this $200 and the emergency fund, in a normal year, I think that will get us through a fiscal year. As I said, this is for a variety of reasons. This has been an unusual year. So I guess that's a longer answer to yes. Now, again, if the Judicial Council decides to increase the per-page rate, then obviously we have a problem. If, the number of transcripts that need to be ordered and the number of appeals goes way up, obviously that's going to be a problem. One of the issues we had, which I think we talked about at least in your committee, and I believe we talked about it in the Senate, was we have had a close to 100% increase in the number of post-conviction cases that we have seen over the last, I think in the last 3 years, maybe it's the last 4 years. Now, is that going to continue? I don't know. I'm hoping not. But, you know, those are the things, again, we don't have any control over.
Mr. Kyer, how many new positions in the public defender's office will the Senate budget fund?
Mr. Chairman and members, a lot of it will depend on what our salary system ends up, where our contract settlements end up this summer. As you all know, we bargain with two bargaining units just like the state does. Taking the $1.9 million off the top again, because that's, you know, replacing existing funding. My guess off the top of my head might be another 25, something like that. Again, depending on where the settlements come in, depending on, you know, a lot of other factors.
Any further questions from any of the members? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kyer, getting back to this technical, so actually the technology pieces and the technology equipment that was to get updated, have you gone out and received any other grants or applied for any grants to fund that? And do you know of any amounts that you've gotten grants to do that? Typically go out and get grants for technology pieces?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick. Not for the staffing portion of this, but we have applied on at least two occasions, I think maybe three, for federal funding for our case and content management system. We've always had good reviews, but we haven't been able to crack the funding piece yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to clarify, you've applied for the grants, but you actually unfortunately haven't received any.
Correct.
Any other questions on this area? Thank you, Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman, members, the next change from the House offer occurs on line 149, page 5. The Youth Intervention Program grant, the Senate had $3 million appropriated, and we lowered that by $1 million to $2 million. So in the next line, line 150, the House had a community offender reentry grant, and the Senate deleted that in its offer. And then the next line down, line 150.
Senate members, before going, Mr. Turner, this was the Duluth program, right?
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay. So this came up in an earlier answer. I just want to make sure we're clear. This is a bill that Senator Reinert introduced that was referred to the full Finance Committee. Senator Reinert did not request a hearing on it. So there was no hearing on the Senate side. The bill was not referred to the Judiciary Division. So we have not had any information or hearing on this particular provision.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
So for clarification, so any bill that has not been heard in the Senate or the opposite body, it cannot be in the bill. Is that correct?
Representative Hillstrom, this is our offer at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seems to be a position which has been taken by the House on a number of important provisions as well. So.
Just want a clarification, Mr. Chair.
You too, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, for the community reentry program, that was Representative Simonson's bill in the House, and that did get a full hearing and passed through, and he couldn't be here this evening because he has another conference committee. But I know Commissioner Roy has worked closely with this program in the past, and I did ask him if he could provide some testimony on it, so if he would be able to do that so we could hear what the program was.
Sure. Commissioner Roy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. Good evening.
Good evening.
This program is commonly called SOAR, S-O-A-R, and it is a reentry program and the only one of its kind in northeastern Minnesota. It serves as a resource for parole officers. They have a staff of one and volunteers. They do counseling to offenders in terms of job readiness, housing assistance, and mentoring offenders after long stays in our prisons. They operate on a shoestring budget. At one time, as a previous director in northern Minnesota, they had a staff of about six, and I think they are down to just the director at this point in time. I will offer myself only as a resource for information, but clearly it is a reentry program that serves northeastern Minnesota very well.
Commissioner, do you know how they're currently funded?
It has been a couple of years, Mr. Chair, it's been a couple of years since I have tracked their funding sources. I know they were grant funded for most of their existence, actually. And there may be some local foundations that also, I think the Duluth Superior Foundation gives them some money also.
Do you know if they receive any funding from the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair, they have not received any funding from the Department of Corrections.
And do you know how other community reentry programs are funded in other parts of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, the department, our department certainly has some of our own staff dedicated to reentry efforts, but there are a myriad of other agencies around the state that rely on local funding, county funding, and grant funding to do reentry services.
And this is in the public safety area of the budget. Does anyone know if DTS funds it?
It's OJP money, I believe.
Representative Paymar?
I believe it's OJP money. It's an OJP grant through the Department of Public Safety.
That's
Senator Dibble.
That would have then come through our division.
And are there other community offender reentry programs that are funded through OJP as well?
Commissioner Allison is here. She can.
Commissioner Allison.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Allison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The Office of Justice Programs does have a history of funding reentry programs. I don't have a list in front of me of the various reentry programs that we currently fund. I certainly can get that to the committee, but I don't have that tonight.
I guess one of the questions to ask is, the obvious question to ask is, why is this particular program in Duluth singled out for special funding from a direct legislative appropriation as compared to any other community reentry program in the state? So if there's anyone who can help me understand that.
Would you say that again?
Why is this particular program in Duluth singled out for direct appropriation from the state as compared to any other community reentry program?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just take a stab, I know that we have funded in the past, and I believe it's not in this bill, the network, which is a reentry program in Minneapolis, gets a fair amount of funding in both the state and Senate bills, although they're not in here, but they're in the housing bills, and that's a reentry program that has received funding from the legislature before. The Department of Corrections has its share of reentry efforts, but from my vantage point, when there's innovative programs, whether it's in the metro or in the Arrowhead, I think that we should be supporting them because if you don't offer these folks a chance when they get out of the institution that they're in, they're going to be right back in there. And whether it's counseling or help getting housing or jobs, it it's a small amount of money, I think, that they're requesting, and I think we should.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's my understanding that if they don't get funding from the state, I believe they are at risk of losing the program, which would be a tremendous loss to that area of the state.
Representative Moline? I'm sorry, did you have your hand up earlier?
No, that's okay, Mr. Chair. If I'm just wondering, is it normally, because my memory is failing me, and I did meet with the executive director, and Commissioner Roy is correct that she is the only person there. They've cut all their staff. She is the executive director and the only staff person. She runs the whole reentry program. And from my understanding, if they didn't get this funding this year, they would shut down because it's their entire budget. But maybe the deputy commissioner knows, is it normally a competitive grant process, or you know, why would SOAR be in the situation where they have lost all of their state funding?
Commissioner Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can only speculate, but the way it normally works is that we have a certain amount of money that we put out, federal money and state money for grants. People make competitive applications. The applications are scored, and those that get the top ranking are funded, and we consider the ranking and then also the geographic area of the state. So we try to spread the money around at different parts of the state as much as possible. What typically happens, and I can only speculate, what typically happens is people apply for the grants thinking that if they demonstrate their efficacy, then the funding will be picked up by the local government. Of course, local governments have been under stress, and so oftentimes we see grantees who have received state or federal funding through the Office of Justice programs that over the years then have difficulty replacing that funding with local or sustainable funding. It's not uncommon.
Representative Moline.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, is there another reentry program in Duluth or in the Arrowhead that you're aware of? Or is there another reentry program that receives money from the OJP, since you said that you try to spread the money throughout the state? So is there another program in Duluth or the Arrowhead region?
Commissioner Ellis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have a list of all of our grantees with me tonight, but I can certainly get that tomorrow and give it to the committee. So I'm not sure.
Representative Moline.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And maybe Commissioner Roy knows, but if I'm remembering correctly, SOAR is the only reentry program in Duluth. And it actually doesn't serve the entire Arrowhead. It just serves the city of Duluth. But from my understanding, it's the only reentry program in Duluth.
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, you are correct in that notion that they are the only labeled reentry program, but there certainly are other public agencies that serve other components of reentry, housing, social services, counseling, but they really focus on offenders leaving our prisons, and they are the only ones doing that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other thoughts on the conference committee at this time on this question? All right. Thank you. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the next change from the House offers, the next line down, line 151, the Senate took its position on the sex trafficking victim training, $300,000, saving $350,000 from that line, and then the House position also included $100,000 to the post board for specifying training in sex offender trafficking police work. And that, once again, we took the Senate position of just straight county $100,000 each year for local government reimbursement for police training, and we did not specify sex trafficking.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
So I don't understand that, why you did that. I mean, that's the two are connected, so why, Mr. Turner, I don't understand what you're saying then, maybe.
Sure.
Relative to the post board line item.
Representative Paymar, the original, in the Senate, this was Senator Pappas's initiative, and it was funded
outside of our budget on the bottom line from the Finance Committee in the amount that Senator Pappas requested of $300,000, which we have been informed was the amount that the Ramsey County Attorney's Office had requested to fund their initiative. We had separately, completely unrelated to that, had funded the post board an additional $200,000 over the biennium for local training reimbursements, just because we knew that they had been short and stressed from past budgets and they needed some more. So we found some money for that purpose. So we had some concern that if the initiative itself were not funded in our bill, that it might get dropped outside of our process through the Finance Committee, and this way we keep control over it to make sure it does get funded. So we incorporated the $300,000 into our budget here for the training program through the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. We did not, which again was the amount that they had initially requested from us in the Senate. The supplemental aspect of that, which County Attorney Choi testified to, was sort of a second segment of that and a very expansive array of training. It included, well, at the time we asked for the information, it wasn't available. It was subsequently provided to this committee. $200,000 in outside consultants for small group training around the state. Another $100,000 or so, if I remember right, for quarterly regional trainings around the state. $150,000 to the county attorney's office to coordinate everything. It's the impression that I got. I'm summarizing here. There was a two-page letter that we all received. Essentially, we funded what the program had asked for from the Senate when we heard the request, and we did not fund the second supplemental portion of that program.
Mr. Chair,
I hope that answers your question, Representative Damon.
Mr. Chair, sort of, but I think we'll need to look at that information from Ramsey County Attorney Choi, because the importance of earmarking that money to the post board for this project is that the project doesn't work if you're unless you just want to fund law enforcement agencies in the metropolitan area. So the idea was, with this concept, is that there would be regional trainings and that the post board would reimburse local law enforcement agencies to send officers to these trainings, so that Greater Minnesota would be exposed to the innovative project that Ramsey County has developed this past year in dealing with children who are being sex trafficked. So this money, that the $300,000, and what did we have in our budget, was
$750.
The $375 was to develop in the first year, was to develop the curriculum and this toolkit for the training. The post board money was to reimburse the officers. The rest of the money was ongoing money that wasn't going to Ramsey County, but would be used specifically for grant programs dealing with sex trafficking. So it's recognizing the fact that this is a huge problem. It's not just in the metro area, it's statewide, and that there would be grants made to OJP for, whatever kind of training. I mean, if you remember correctly, they asked originally for $10 million, I think, and I think in both of our bills we have maybe $3 million to fund this project.
$3 million?
What is the, Mr. Waltz, do you know what it is?
Wait. Who had asked for $10 million?
The Safe Harbor program originally asked for, I believe, $10 million for housing, for advocates, for law enforcement training. Senator Dibble, I think, maybe knows the answer to this, but
right. That, Senator Dibble.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think some of those other pieces are being carried in the Health and Human Services bill and then in the Economic Development bill, the housing and some of the services associated with housing.
Okay. And Mr. Bauer is here if we need some clarification, but I do think I'm trying to point out that I think that it's not, you know, it's underfunded in terms of the goals that they had, obviously, and we're just in our little piece of the budget here trying to fix the law enforcement prosecutor aspect of this program that's critical, I think. So maybe you can clarify this, Mr. Bauer.
Somehow baffles me as to why the request, at least through the Senate author, was only for $300,000 for this piece thing. Maybe Mr. Bauer can explain that too. Welcome, Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jeff Bauer, Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. I actually just ran over here from the HHS Conference Committee, so if you wouldn't mind repeating the the question, what you'd like me to report the committee.
Is that okay, Mark?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bauer, we're just trying to get at the we had allocated $375,000 to Ramsey County to develop this curriculum and the training kit. And then we had also appropriated $200,000 over the biennium to the post board to reimburse law enforcement officers to come to these regional trainings after the toolkit curriculum was developed by Ramsey County. So we're just trying to make sure that the request adds up, because the Senate has a very different number. And they've also not earmarked that money to the post board for this specific purpose.
So, Mr. Chair, members, just a very quick overview. This the Safe Harbor bill started as one comprehensive bill. It was roughly $13.5 million. It was split sort of between the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. And what's happened as we've moved along is certain parts of the bill have split up a bit. And so the training fund that you're considering was not included in either the House or the Senate versions of the HHS finance bill. And what we ended up doing was trying to then attach that to the public safety and judiciary bills. Earlier in the Senate process, we tried to do that. We weren't successful in doing that. Senator Cohen and Finance Committee indicated that there might be some room on the bottom line for a little bit for this training fund. That amount that he indicated at that time was $300,000, so that's why the Senate has the $300,000. We were able to, on the House side, find a bit more. So our original request for the Safe Harbor Training Fund was $750,000. In the original legislation. It was recommended later in the process that it would be a good idea to reimburse officers for their time for the training through the post board at that time. So that's where we stand. There isn't training money anywhere else in the HHS budget bills. This is the only place where that's being considered.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Melton's here. Mr. Melton's here from the post board, if you... any questions about that end of it?
Mr. Melton?
Good evening.
Welcome, Mr. Melton.
I'm Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Post Board. And from what I understand, the money that would come through Post as a conduit for the training would be reimbursed back to local units of government once they've made an application, proof of attendance, somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 per day per officer. Basically, first come, first serve.
Mr. Melton, what has been your experience with regard to sufficiency of funding for the generalized law enforcement training?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Currently, the reimbursement per officer annually is about $334, down from a high 15 years ago when it was $477. So the training reimbursement for local units of government has gone down. And as a rule of thumb, the reimbursement covers about 15% of actual training costs.
In other words, you're short all around.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions or comments from the conference committee members? All right. Thank you, both of you.
Yeah.
Mr. Turner?
So Mr. Chairman and members, the next three changes are all related to the inmate Medicaid eligibility savings. Line 200.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Paymar.
Are we going to skip over lines 152, 153?
No change.
Of course we are.
Or do you want to discuss them? Then they're not in the House offer. They are in the House offer, but I these bills were not heard in the House, and I'm just wondering.
Representative Paymar, these were not changes from the House offer, so we didn't have any further explanation.
Okay, but just,
for them, but certainly if you have questions or something about them.
No, to piggyback on Representative Hillstrom was saying, I mean, we did not hear these bills, and we thought we know of the programs and think that they're worthy, but we didn't hear them, and we were offering them since you think they're important, but... just trying to get at what was asked before about the consistency of whether we're going to have a rule on this or what you're thinking is when we make our counteroffer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we fully funded Representative Hillstrom's priority initiative, specialty funding for the courts, without hearing anything in the Senate about that as well. So I think it's fair to say we're both exercising our principles as we see fit at the particular line that we're dealing with.
Okay.
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members. Move to line 213, and like I said, the next three items are related to the inmate Medicaid eligibility savings. The first one is the savings retained by DOC. We lowered the amount that DOC retained by $1,017,000. Then on line 226, we lowered the appropriation for the Community Corrections Act subsidy by $1,145,000. Then on line 227, we lowered the appropriation for County Probation Officer reimbursement by $84,000. And as I said at the beginning, these changes, mostly savings, came because it's the Senate position that there be no fees in this bill. So the next two items are we deleted the bond reinstatement fee and we deleted the conciliation court fee. And then in your offer, it's very nice. You left us $947,000 on the bottom line, and that's used to balance the bill. One thing I would like to point out, non-general fund items. The Senate offer deletes the court technology fee. The Senate accepts the $5 million transfer from driver services account, and it also accepts trunk highway funding for forensic labs at the BCA.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to explore the technology fee piece, and if the Senate has an absolute aversion to funding of technology and setting the state on a path to actually implement e-discovery and e-filing, or if this was just part of the offer, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, it clearly was part of the offer. And I think you probably will find general agreement that the state ought to be investing in technology. I think the question was really, how is that accomplished and who pays for it? And my understanding from leadership was that we were given an increase in our targets with the particular goal of avoiding fee increases in this budget, with direction both certainly from the leadership that came up with the target and from the governor's office that they were highly resistant to fee increases, as they would be borne by the broad general public, but in particular those who are seeking to access the justice system, and would serve as something of an impediment or an increased barrier in accessing the justice system. So I think that was the theory behind it, and avoiding all of these fees. As you know, Representative Hillstrom, from the very beginning of this process, going back several months now, I indicated to you that I was highly resistant to fees. You indicated the same thing to me. Unfortunately, you were not given a target that enabled you to implement your budget without fees. I was, and I think we've shown how in the Senate offer here we can implement the budget without fees. It's a question of whether every item there is funded and funded at the level desired by the recipients of the funding.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make it really clear that the direction that we were given about fees, of course, the criminal traffic surcharge was off the table. However, the direction is that fees are to be negotiated on policy merit. And, Mr. Chair, I think that merit of taking making certain that all of the partners in justice have the ability to implement e-discovery and e-filing is something that is very, very important, especially, as you know, we have more and more pro se defendants. And for them to simply be given a disk and not have the ability to open it in the courtroom is only going to slow down justice. And so you can measure access to justice in more than one way, Mr. Chair. And so I hope that you will keep an open mind as you receive our next offer.
Representative Hillstrom, I certainly don't quarrel with the goals. Mr. Backus, would you like to take us through the other positions here?
Mr. Chair, members, then I'll be working off of the sheet that's entitled Senate Counteroffer Non-Rider Items. And as that indicates, that's an attempt to make our way through the remaining portions of the bill, the non-riders. The first, I think it's five cells, relate to House Article 2. These basically all relate to the spreadsheet, so we probably don't need to go into much detail, but it's the court technology fee, the criminal traffic surcharge, the conciliation court fee increase, the bond forfeiture fee. Those fees, basically it's the Senate position, except the criminal and traffic surcharge the House had already essentially offered to take the Senate position, so I guess we'd be taking you up on that. The other issue is the Court of Appeals judge reimbursement issue, which, as you've seen, the Senate position is the Senate position. That's our offer. Continuing then, House Article 3, Sections 1 to 7, basically the Senate would accept the House offer, which Representative Hillstrom articulated as basically being the current Senate language in the Health and Human Services bill. So the Senate would agree to take that language in this bill. However, as the sheet says, there would be no appropriation accompanying it.
On that point, it was my understanding, Representative Hillstrom, you had expressed a desire to carry that in this bill. I think in part just to make sure it happened.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I understand that and I respect that. And as you know, I carried the bill in the Senate side of it, and I spoke with Senator Lurie about this earlier today, and he doesn't particularly care where it's carried. It's revenue neutral in terms of the fees that fund the activities, and he doesn't really care if it's in his bill or our bill, as long as it goes through, and he'd probably be happy to have a little less complicated bill if it could possibly be made so. So understanding your preference to carry it in this bill, I thought it appropriate to retain that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's make it clear that then we are carrying a fee in our bill, Mr. Chair.
This is a revenue neutral fee to pay specifically for the program. If you wish to keep the fees out of the bill, we can let Senator Lori carry it in his bill.
No, I'm fine, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, have a little discussion here.
You're going to hoist me on my own petard here for accommodating your desire. Is that it, Representative Hillstrom? That'll teach me. All right. Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, then the remaining provisions essentially are from, I believe, Representative Paymar's bill and then the Senate provisions that line up with it. So the first provision is the House from the unofficial engrossment of 671, House Section 8, which is the trunk highway fund where the House statutorily limits the appropriations. It allows BCA lab expenses to be funded with trunk highway fund dollars. The Senate position here is the Senate position, which means there'd be no statutory change on this issue. The next cell is the issues. The Senate and House have identical provisions on the Department of Corrections offenders from other jurisdictions, so the Senate would offer to accept the identical provisions. The next cell is similar. It's the Department of Human Rights Certificates of Compliance. Again, we have identical provisions there that we would just accept. The next provision, then, is the House provision on felony fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct. That's been discussed here already. The Senate offer would be the Senate position, which is not to do that. The next provision is the...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
I'm wondering if this would be the appropriate time, since Minicasa was going to testify earlier today but was not prepared, if they still wanted to, and if we could hear some brief testimony about the proposed changes
sure.
to that bill.
Sure. Is there someone here from Minicasa that would like to testify on this point? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. My name is, Donna Dunn. I'm the director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and we appreciate this opportunity to speak briefly to the work that we've been doing around fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, which at this point is not ever an enhanceable crime for repeat offenses. At Minicasa, we've been working on this particular issue for about 5 years, have often met bipartisan support for the concept that we have presented and that Caroline Palmer, our staff attorney, will speak to. We want to just say briefly that fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct are, in fact, real sex crimes. They are of a lower, a lower level of violence for sure, but in fact, they are traumatizing events for those people who have experienced them. Just recently, we did hear of an experience of a sheriff's deputy, a female who was not in uniform, was out on the street, walking down the street, and was approached by an offender who rapidly grabbed her in the crotch, tried to push her down. She was able to fend off the attack, and once she regained her composure and was no longer frozen by the event, she did in fact chase down the offender and brought him down with help from bystanders. And she has reportedly said that this is a fifth degree offense. This is how it was charged, and I believe the offender was convicted. And this is a kind of fifth-degree offense that would not be charged at a felony level, but, however, was quite traumatizing to the person who experienced it. And I'd like to point out that she clearly is somebody who is trained to respond to this kind of personal invasion. She's trained as somebody in physical attributes that clearly that police officers and detectives and deputies need to be trained in. So this is a person who could, in fact, fend off the event and she herself experienced trauma at the hands of this person. So we wanted to make the point that fifth degree offenses are not nuisance offenses, they're not serious offenses, and in fact, when offenders continue to repeat at this level of offense, we are looking at, in fact, something that we want to have you all and have us all take very seriously in Minnesota statute. This is a priority for us. This is not necessarily a nuisance. These are not nuisance crimes, but they are. This is, in fact, an opportunity for us to intervene at a low level and offer an opportunity for holding these offenders accountable when they and if they should continue to repeat these offenses. I'd like to now actually turn things over to Caroline Palmer, our staff attorney, who can describe some of the specifics and the changes that we have offered to meet some of the challenges that we've heard from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the committee members. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I just would like to take an opportunity to give you a bit more background and walk you through some of the changes that we have proposed to the committee tonight. First of all, we would like to thank Senator Latz for scheduling the hearing on Senate File 1022. We, as Donna had mentioned, we've been working on this bill for a long time through several legislative cycles, and we've had House hearings along the way, but this was the first time we had an opportunity to bring it to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And many, many thoughtful ideas were presented during that hearing, and so we've incorporated them in the changes that we're bringing to the committee today. Unfortunately, the hearing that we had on this bill was not scheduled to the last day before the deadline, so that's why we didn't have an opportunity to act on those changes until we brought them to you today. So I'm just going to briefly outline what we learned from the committee and how we responded to them in the new draft. And we really do hope that these can address everybody's concerns in a satisfactory manner. First of all, we learned from Senator Latz that for this crime, a pattern of harmful behavior may be more appropriately established upon a third offense, and we do agree with this change. Next, we learned from Senators Latz and Goodwin that the more appropriate response to a second conviction might be an extended probationary period, one that accommodates and supports a meaningful treatment intervention. And we definitely agree with this at MnCASA. We believe that treatment is critical in this response to fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct. And really, this could even be the optimal time for a treatment intervention before the crime escalates to something worse. And finally, we learned from Senator Goodwin that we need to recognize that actions as a minor may not have the same relevance in establishing a pattern of behavior resulting in fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct. And we definitely agree that any approach to juvenile sex offenders needs to be taken very thoughtfully in thinking about what the future consequences are for the juvenile. So what we've proposed is that there be a look-back period applied to any enhancement of repeat fifth-degree convictions to a felony. But what we would also look at is that we believe at least one of the repeat convictions would need to occur when the individual is an adult. So let's say a juvenile has adjudications. If they don't have any adult adjudications, it wouldn't be applicable. So we have worked hard to work with this draft language to accommodate these concerns. These are all really good ideas. And what we did provide to you was a bill summary of the compromise language. I believe everybody has a copy of it. And I'll just briefly highlight a couple of points for you. As you can see in our new draft that we've brought along, we haven't changed anything about how the crime is defined in Subdivision 1. Clause 1 defines fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct as non-consensual sexual contact, and Clause 2 defines a specific type of fifth-degree crim sex, which involves masturbation or lewd exhibition in the presence of a minor. Where you will see changes is in the area of a gross misdemeanor. Subdivision 2A outlines the current penalty, and then Subdivision 2B addresses some of the concerns that were brought forward in the Judiciary Committee. It does require a sentence of 6 years probation, which really is the optimal amount of time to accommodate treatment. We recognize that there needs to be time for psychosexual evaluation. There needs to be time usually for chemical dependency or alcohol dependency treatment, and then sex offender treatment itself, which can take a number of years. This also states that it applies only to repeat conviction that occurs within 15 years of a previous conviction or adjudication of delinquency. And just a side note, we wanted to let you know that under a different statute, under current law, which is Minnesota Statute 609.3457, A psychosexual evaluation is ordered when a person commits a sex offense, and most judges will then order an offender to follow all treatment recommendations stemming from the evaluation. So that already exists in current law. And finally, in the changes that you're seeing, and I see they're being handed out, this has to do with the felony. The first part of this recognizes what actually already exists in current law. There is already an enhancement for violations of Subdivision 1, Clause 2, which has to do with the masturbation or lewd exhibition in the presence of a minor. And it also lists a number of different types of statutes, if they're violated ahead of time, could add to the enhancement. And then Subdivision 3B enhances to a felony the third conviction for fifth-degree crim sex. It adds a penalty of 10 years or a $20,000 fine. Those three convictions must occur within a 15-year period and requires that one of those would be an adult conviction. So as I mentioned, some of the different prior types of crimes that would occur that could lead to the enhancement that have been added in include criminal sexual conduct, indecent exposure in front of a minor, use of minors in a sexual performance, or possession of pornographic work involving minors. So we do expand some of the prior types of crimes that would create the enhancement. I also just wanted to note that this is not entirely unusual in the statutes for there to be a criminal section that enhances from a misdemeanor to a felony. Some of the other examples are in domestic assault or violations of an order for protection, driving under the influence, domestic abuse, no contact order violations, and harassment restraining order violations. So tonight it's our request that this conference committee consider the opportunity for this compromise and consider the opportunity to recognize repeat convictions for this kind of sexual violence. It would be nice to have an opportunity to have another penalty beside a gross misdemeanor to address the public safety harms that are created by repeat pattern offenders. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Senator Goodman.
Mr. Chair, can I just...
Sorry, Representative Palmer.
I just... Ms. Takenholtz just informed me that this is not... most updated version, I guess, of the. So what you're looking at is not the most updated version of the MnCASA proposal.
We do have another. Should I go ahead? Yeah, we do have another version here. We can provide that as well.
Yeah, I think the committee ought to look at whatever the current proposal is.
And I can, Mr. Chair, explain an additional piece that's on this new version as it goes around, too. Yes.
Do you have copies to for all of us?
Should be.
Ms. Palmer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the only thing that has been added, all of the changes I just discussed are on that same version. And then additionally, we consulted with the sentencing guidelines folks who are here tonight, and we made an additional change in the statute to 609.135 subdivision 2B. And essentially what this does is make the penalty section of the misdemeanor portion work. It recognizes that there would be a six-year probation period for violation of this type of crime. Currently, this type of crime would be eligible for a two-year probationary period, and our concern has been that that's not enough time in order to complete treatment and get all the needs in line. And we heard the committee say before that we wanted to have enough time for that. So we are requesting an addition to 609.135 that would add this portion of the statute so that it would be eligible for a six-year probation period. And that way, there wouldn't be any confusion for the courts when they would apply this.
Sorry, Ms. Palmer, I'm looking at a draft dated today that does not have a time with it and a draft dated today that has a 7 p.m. Time on it. And can you point out to me where the difference is in subdivision 2B?
Are you referring to, Mr. Chair, are you referring to the penalty change in the sentencing portion or...
I think I heard you just say that there was an additional change in subdivision 2B, as in boy.
Oh, sorry. That change Mr. Chair, is in 609.135, and it has the same subdivision 2B, and it should be on that copy we provided.
Okay.
I forgot it.
Thank you.
Mm-mm. Thank you.
We don't all have
that. Don't all have
Senator Goodman, do you have?
No.
They're making copies.
Do you have the one that's stapled? We don't have it all yet.
They said they're making more copies.
All right.
I'm sure I got a question about another section.
Okay. Well, Senator Goodwin had a question first, and then we'll go to Representative Lush. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did ask a number of questions in our committee when this bill came up, and I am concerned about sexual misconduct. I'm also concerned about creating felonies. That's a serious thing, and we take it very seriously in our Judiciary Committee, and we don't do that with a 15-minute explanation of a bill. I'm also concerned about youth that are in middle school when they're pretty rambunctious and can do a lot of silly, stupid things like we all did when we were in middle school and learn from. But and we talked about keeping the juvenile record up here, but you don't do that. You go back 15 years, and that can cover the offenses of a juvenile. You only say that one of the offenses has to be as an adult. So it could be something as simple as, and I understand the issue that the detective had. I just don't feel comfortable that it's proven that we need a felony conviction for this. I do think that we probably definitely need treatment, probably most likely need a longer probation period. But I really want to study the effects of this because when we have laws covering sexual issues, those people are labeled for the rest of their life. And if a juvenile did a couple of stupid things and then does another stupid thing as an adult, and as a juvenile, the parent prosecutes or makes sure that the child gets prosecuted for what could be a stupid thing, a mean thing, but a stupid thing. And then we end up with this another person with a felony conviction that can't get housing, that can't get a job when they get out, that ends up not getting treatment anyway when they're in prison. And it just doesn't make sense to me that we would do this with a little short time we had to really look at this bill and talk about all the aspects of it. I think this deserves a hearing, a longer hearing with more testimony, more cases that we can look at. So far, I've heard the one case. That's all I've heard. And not that's that we haven't done other things on a one-case basis. But when it's a felony, we really have to be careful about this. And I really would like to have this bill in committee next year and really be able to take a look at it. Right now, I don't feel comfortable at all with the way this is drafted. And even your redrafts, which I appreciate and I thank you for, I just still have concerns. We've got degrees of sexual conduct for a reason. And we've got degrees, and we might want to change those degrees and put felonies in a different degree. But because I do think we have to have consequences for actions that are sexually aggressive, even if they're not rape or something like that. But I also do think that it has to be appropriate. Maybe we have to divide them out better. So ones that are really a sexual assault is what you had there. It wasn't a touching or a incident. It was an assault. It was a physical sexual assault. And it seems to me like that would have been, and he did end up getting punished, this person, without this legislation. He did end up with a conviction. So I'm just wanting to be more careful than what we can be in a conference committee. And this bill was laid over specifically so we could study the issue over a period of time. And so I still have really strong objections, I have to say, to doing this now in conference committee.
Representative Lush, and then we'll go to Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand this, Ms. Palmer, Ms. Dunn, I prosecuted some fifth degree. It was probably over 10 years ago, though, and I can't distinctly recall all the elements and how they were proven. But to use an example of dovetailing off of Senator Goodwin's comments, a lot of lewd things go on in high school boys' locker rooms. So let's say you've got the goon who's making it a habit of mooning and hazing freshmen players on a football team. Would it be your intention that on a third time that would be a felony?
Ms. Palmer.
Representative Lesch, if he did it three times as a juvenile, or are you talking if he then did something again as an adult?
As an adult.
Representative Lesch. Ms. Palmer.
So, yes, we would require that one of those repeat offenses would need to be as an adult.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm...
Representative Lesch.
Yeah, I understand the intent, and I understand the situations that this is intended to encompass, and I have some sympathy for that, but I wonder about that situation and whether it really is appropriate for that to be a felony. That's all I'll say, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering what is the history of this? Didn't you have this before us before last year? What was the outcome, or how long is this? Have you presented this? You've had hearing on it before, haven't you?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we had it. We brought it forward for the past 5 years, and it has made it through the House committee each time we have brought it forward.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, when it has been brought through the House committees, it's never really met opposition. It's been unanimous adoption on a bipartisan basis.
Well, the holdup is in the Senate.
Representative Cornish. Pardon me?
So the holdup is in the Senate then?
Not while I was chair.
Oh. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could. In response to Representative Lesch's example, actually this fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct requires contact. It is not having somebody display lewd behavior from a similar age person to a similar age person. It's really not mooning or displaying lewd behavior. We're talking about touch. We're talking about contact that has sexual or aggressive intent.
Mr. Chair,
Parens
2 specifically says the person engages in masturbation or lewd exhibition of the genitals in the presence of a minor under the age of 16, mm-hmm. knowing or not having okay. reason to know the minor is present.
Okay.
So maybe
mm-hmm.
I'm misunderstanding that. But
no, I'm sorry. That is correct. I was mistaken thinking that that had to do with an adult who was doing that behavior in the presence of a minor.
And Mr. Chair, what is the age of an adult, 18 or 21, in criminal statute?
18.
So it could be an 18-year-old high school student or a 19-year-old high school student that did the stupid things like that and then were convicted as an adult. That's my point, is there's all kinds of situations like this that I think could be dangerous to just brush over. Just make it a felony offense and create a whole new group of criminals that can't ever get jobs or can't ever get housing. And I think we need to be so careful about that. After the description that Representative Lesch has on that is just one example of how we would be really doing an injustice to serious sexual offenses and what we want to accomplish with those and to kids, dumb kids, kids that aren't thinking, kids that are doing things that are just, dumb kid behavior. They could grow up and be fine citizens, but at that particular point in their life, their hormones are raging and they're not acting real sane. And I've had kids that age, so I know. They're great now, but they weren't. So that's my, I really feel strongly about that. for our side. That I don't know what happened in the past with the Senate. I was on Judiciary the last 2 years. We didn't hear this bill, but I think even in the when the party change happened, or before the party change happened this year, under the Republican administration in the Senate, they also were very careful about creating felony offenses. And I think that's kind of a bipartisan position. We really want to be careful about creating new felonies.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Ms. Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin. And at Mikasa, we share your concerns, too. We don't take this lightly in creating a new felony. And we also don't take lightly the issue of how this could affect juvenile offenders, because we want young people to have an opportunity to rehabilitate. But what we are looking at is people who are repeating crimes. And the prosecutors who work with our public policy committee tell us, you know, not just about people they see three times, but six times, seven times, 10 times coming through their court. And at some point, there needs to be an intervention with them in order to get them the treatment that they need so that maybe they will stop this behavior or not progress to something worse. And also to your question about additional examples, another example I can think of was in the past couple of years around the University of Minnesota. There was a man who was coming up behind female students or passersby and groping them in the crotch. And it was a similar type of thing, what happened to the sheriff's deputy that Ms. Dunn described. And so, again, a lot of times these types of crimes are not always between people who know each other. Sometimes they're stranger crimes on the street, something like the ones we've described here. And, again, very traumatizing for the victim who is on the receiving end of that.
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Senator Goodman.
Thank you. Has this been through Sentencing Guidelines Commission? Have they processed this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, we actually consulted just now with Sentencing Guidelines, and they gave us that additional information that we provided to you, but it hasn't been through the commission's board, per se.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that would be an important part of making a decision on this. And again, I would say I think we should look at it very seriously next year, but not include it this year until some of these issues get straightened out.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Goodwin, do you have concerns with the pieces that are not the felony piece, the extended probation language that they've talked about, where they've amended the language to allow for up to 6 years of probation to actually take care of some of the treatment needs? Or is your concern just once it raises to the level of probation? Because there's many pieces in this that are not the felony piece.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Representative Hillstrom, it's new penalties all around. What is the penalty now for fifth-degree criminal sexual contact or conduct? What is the penalty overall? Misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor?
Mr. Chair, members, it's a gross misdemeanor for the normal offense.
Okay. So then that's not really a new penalty for that group. And so that, 6 years is the difference, is the length of the probation period.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Goodwin, that's my question. So it isn't a new penalty, that piece, not the felony piece, but it does allow for a six-year probation. So my question is your concern with the creation of the felony, or do you have concern with extending the probationary period to 6 years to allow for the treatment and the other pieces in this proposal?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Goodwin.
No, I don't have problems with that, unless, again, I still want us to really look closely at whether or not we want to include juvenile actions in this, even in this section.
Mr. Backus, are there other crimes that have extended probationary periods?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have the statutes in front of me anymore, but we do have extended probation for certain offenses, like the DWI offenses. So, like the normal misdemeanor stay period is extended for DWI, and I think maybe one of the domestic abuse, I'd have to look. But in general, that's the exception, not the rule.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that criminal sexual conduct is at least something that warrants discussion in terms of that extended probation, even if there are concerns about other pieces. So I'm hoping that this isn't just completely off the table as we continue to discuss, and I look forward to hearing if there are other extended probationary agreements. Clearly, we do have that in the statute. Again, I know for sure DWIs. And so I hope you keep an open mind about those pieces.
All right. See. Representative Moline.
Yeah. Senator Latz, I just have a question for the testifiers on subdivision 3B. I'm just wondering where you came up with the 15 years where you have to – the third violation basically has to be within 15 years after the first, and I'm just wondering if that's found in other statutes or why that 15 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 15 years, one of the places you may see that is in the sentencing guidelines that has to do with presumptive executed sentences for repeat offenders. So that's one place where you see it. You might, in other parts of the statute, see 10 years, but we went with 15 years right now because we had seen that in other parts of the CrimSec statutes.
Well,
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, and I guess and that's a pretty long time, especially with juveniles included. I mean, they could have had an offense at 15 or 16 years old and then not have their third until they're 30. So 15 years is a pretty long span. So, you know, we are going to be moving forward with it. And I have some serious concerns as well with the collateral consequences that juveniles face as a result of any criminal record, but especially anything related to a sex offense. So, but, you know, to put that long a time on it is concerning to me as well.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I have to say that when this bill originally came to us, there was no time limit, so you could look back forever. And that was not at all acceptable. But even this part here, like you said, you look back 15 years. That's a long time. The other issue is whether or not we should be looking at the juvenile record at all. I don't know. You know, I'm just thinking that's so. I think that's something else that we need to think more about.
All right. Not seeing any other questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, the next provision in the that Senate offer sheet is the next provision in the side-by-side, which is a House provision on the mandatory sentence for repeat sex offenders. If you recall, the Senate has a bill on this, a standalone bill, which is, I believe, it's either in the Finance Committee or on the floor now, and the Senate's carrying costs for this. So the Senate offer here is essentially the introduced version of that provision. We referenced Senate File 1241, but obviously that would be the same as the introduced House version. The House changed that provision in committee, and the Senate never picked up that language. Mr. Chair, then continuing, the next provision is the Senate-only provision on the amendment to the 2011 Civil Legal Services Rider. The Senate offer is to take the Senate position on that. The next provision is a House-only provision, the Juvenile Justice System Report. The Senate offer would be to accept the House position on that. I'm sorry, to take that study, that report.
Chair.
Representative Pamela.
Can we go back to the rider? Which is this the rider that eliminates the provision in law that disallows legal aid from engaging in class action? Is this the class action suits, federal suits?
Yeah, it's the federal. The federal suit. The previous restriction was contained, I think, in budget rider language, so one could argue that it expired by its own terms and no longer would have the force and effect of law in the future, coming biennium. And but just to be sure, I guess we're deleting that.
It was not in the House.
Mr. Chair, members, the House provision, if I recall correctly, has a rider authorizing the civil legal services. I forget exactly how it's worded to use the money. I think Representative Hillstrom may have said that the House position is that that would essentially be the same thing. We didn't know about that at the time. So what the Senate does is it specifically strikes that language, and it's on R38 of the side-by-side. So, you know, I think, again, the Senate position is essentially better safe than sorry. We're not exactly sure we really need to do this, but certainly if you support that position, no harm in striking that language.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, then the next provision is the Senate has specific language on page R39 dealing with the judicial salary increase. So what the Senate offer is to include that provision, but to amend it to reflect the House numbers that that the Senate has already put in the offer sheet that Mr. Turner spoke about earlier. And then the final provision is the Senate has a Senate-only provision on page R40, which is a Department of Corrections, Department of Human Services interagency agreement. And the offer would be to accept the Senate position on that. And that's related to the MA savings. And, Mr. Chair, that's the end of the offer sheet.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you could just clarify what that really is. This relates to the language. It relates to the money. It relates to, if you could just clarify what that specifically does.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Turner.
Representative Hillstrom, this is a rider that was put together, that was drafted by our Human Services Fiscal Analyst, and that was put in to make sure that the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services follow the legislative intent and Medicaid, inpatient, inmate, Medicaid eligibility.
Thank you.
Mr. Backus?
And Mr. Chair, perhaps House staff could elaborate here, but our side-by-side summary indicates that the House does not have a comparable provision in this bill, but in the House Human Services bill, I believe there's either similar language or a similar concept. I'm not specifically familiar with what it says, but the House has something similar.
Mr. Chair, there,
Representative Paymore.
We offered that as an amendment to the Health and Human Services bill.
So is that being carried in the Health and Human Services bill on the House side of things?
Is that the amendment that we have sent?
No.
Okay, I guess it's not quite the same. But it's getting to the heart of making sure. Chair, it's getting to the heart of making sure that we're able to maintain those savings from the changes in the Affordable Care Act vis-a-vis MA. So our language is slightly different in the amendment. But which is it's capped at the fiscal note that was prepared by the Department of Corrections and Health and Human Services. And Human Services.
Yeah. Which was what amount?
Wake me up when I come to a conclusion.
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, the House has a similar provision. It's in the Human Services bill. And what it seeks to do is have the Department of Corrections make these transfers for the state and county share of MA costs due to these inmates receiving inpatient service. However, the House provision takes the amounts in the fiscal note that the Department of Human Services estimated would be that state share and caps it at that amount. Without that cap, if their estimates were off and the costs were much higher, the Department of Corrections would be on the hook for costs that we have not given them in their budget.
Any other questions or anything you'd like to say with regard to what we've just gone over this evening? You wish to accept the Senate offer in its entirety?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you still have the gavel for 2 hours. Is it your intent?
Unless the committee consents to go another hour beyond that.
So,
no.
Mr. Chair, my question is, do you then envision that we would have time to break? We would come back potentially with a counteroffer, come back yet this evening, walk through that, or what do you envision at this point for the evening, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hilstrom, I would like to get as far as we can on this tonight, although we've had a bit of a reprieve. I don't know how many people in the audience even know. I should have announced it earlier. The leadership did come up with a common schedule between the House and the Senate, and so this committee's deadline is not midnight tonight, it's midnight tomorrow night. But we are first up.
Oh, good.
I think in the whole series of budget bills, so we absolutely have to get done, and these things perhaps tend to take a little bit longer than we might ever wish to project. So I think it'd be prudent for us to move as far forward as we can tonight and to give us the most flexibility for tomorrow. We've got, I know, a few bills on the Senate floor tomorrow that will have to be in attendance for as well. I don't know what the House floor schedule is, but I'd say let's get as much done as we can any tonight. There'll be a few loose ends that I think we'll have to wrap up tomorrow. Maybe more than a few, we'll have to see.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make it clear, while they've agreed that we can go as late as midnight, of course their request is that we can get it done as early as possible, and by midnight tonight, if we could get it done, would be, you know, a good request. So, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, as I've already described my hope with regard to the NICS database information, and the Senate Finance Committee has scheduled that matter for hearing tomorrow morning at 8:30. So at least as to that one piece, in terms of process, I think we'd probably have to keep the bill open at least until that is heard and see if it moves from there. There may be some other moving parts as well that we'll need to consider. So I don't think we can wrap it up tonight, but if we can at least narrow down the issues that remain to be resolved, I think that would be most helpful for all concerned.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymore.
Well, I just, it's late, but I think we could probably come back with a counteroffer on some of the provisions that are outstanding, but you know, you've got $1 million wrapped into the gun bill that will seriously affect what the final offer would be. So I don't know how much time I want to spend spinning my wheels over that until we know. But, you know, I think we can get, you know, make some progress on some other areas. So I'm wondering if we should just make a counteroffer to you with we can, and then come back tomorrow after Finance Committee has acted on your bill.
I think that's fine. I guess part of it depends on how long, you know, at what time you present us with a counteroffer. We may be in a position to turn a response around quickly yet tonight. So I think we've gathered a lot of information now as to the substantive merits of the positions that we have, and so I'm hopeful that maybe the process of exchanging positions will move along a little more quickly. And I don't think any of us have competing commitments yet tonight. As you know, we were on the floor for a long time this afternoon without the ability to do much else. So, why don't we... I will note, Mr. Turner has whispered to me that your last provision with regard to that interagency agreement, the cap on the MA... he thinks that's a good idea, so that we may be able to quickly resolve that piece as well, just for your information.
Mr. Chair, maybe we could shoot to be back here in less than 30 minutes.
Sounds great.
And we'll text you if that's not we're going to be able to make that target.
Okay. Well, then I will be probably in my office, so let's plan on that. We'll be in recess to the call of the chair.
pull over at that time.